Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg.
Hi, Susan, and hello, listener. Susan, do you have a weather report for us today?
Yes, I do. Today, we'll have scattered showers with thunderstorms also possible afternoon. Mostly cloudy with a high near 60. Chance of precipitation is 50%. New rainfall amounts of less than a tenth of an inch, except higher amounts possible in thunderstorms. Tonight, a chance of showers and thunderstorms before 11 p.m. Then a slight chance of showers. Mostly cloudy with a low around 36. North-northwest wind around 14 miles per hour with gusts as high as 18. Chance of precipitation is 30%. New rainfall amounts of less than one-tenth of an inch, except in higher possible in thunderstorms. Tuesday, mostly sunny, with a high near 53. Breezy. Tuesday night, mostly clear, with a low around 32. North-northwest wind, 5 to 13 miles per hour.
Thank you. Last weekend, an annual event took place, again in southern Iowa, for the 11th time. And that's Prairie Chicken Day, and we wanted to focus on that today for our phenology. This year, the event got national press in USA Today, and almost 100 people gathered at dawn to watch these native birds that were once extinct in Iowa perform their spectacular yearly mating dance in an area which they designate themselves as a dance area called the Lek. Patch Larbaum from the Department of Natural Resources and our own KHOI reporter was really one of the people who brought about the return of the prairie chicken to Iowa, which was extinct. And here's an audio clip of the event that happened last weekend.
Prairie chickens were the birds that were here before pheasants. They were the birds that the early settlers relied upon for protein, either through their eggs or from eating them. The males have this charming inflatable sac at the side of their head, and they have two pinnae feathers that stick straight up. And they have this resonant booming that is essentially a welcome call for the females to come to a certain area called a lek. And a lek is where maybe as many as a dozen males have been dancing since February. The lek is a piece of high ground so that these booming calls can be heard maybe up to a mile away. Boy, it's just a great show. They stamp their little feet and they spin around, and it's almost like pro wrestling where they mock combat, leap in the air and kick at each other, but you never see them take one down and really work them over. It's all in sparring, it's all in the show. They've got these orange tympanums at the side of their head that really is inflated, and that's what creates that booming sound that you're listening to. At this time of year, the hens will come in and kind of stay off to the side and just observe, and the dominant male, the one that has the best dance, usually is consequently the one that passes along those genetics. Native Americans really cherished the prairie chickens. After the demise of the buffalo, it was the prairie chickens that the women could provide protein for the tribe. And the prairie chicken is right up there with the buffalo in many regards. And the dance, consequently, at all the competition dances that the Native community puts on, the prairie chicken dance is the most sacred, the most honored dance.
Ha 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 ha!
prairie chickens were wiped out back in about 1954, and in 1992 we embarked on a mission to try to reestablish prairie chickens, and we went to Kansas, got some birds. It was quite a thing to have them back in an area that we were trying to establish, grasslands. It's near Kellerton, Iowa, in Ringgold County, just off of Highway 2 in southern Iowa. There's a bird conservation area of maybe 2,000 acres for the benefit of the prairie chickens. And then the associated 8,000 to 10,000 acres around those core areas were assisting the farmers with their grassland. It's just a wonderful opportunity to experience southern Iowa in all its glory.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and that was Patch Larbaum reporting from Prairie Chicken Day. Last week and this coming week are when the high points of the mating dance occur. Apparently the male dance is starting in February, but these are the 2 weeks when the females really come to figure out who they like the best. So this is the time for you to drive down to Kellerton to watch if you want to see the show. The DNR provides telescopes to watch the birds from enough distance so as not to disturb them, and we'll post directions on our website at khoifm.org for the instructions on how to drive down to the sanctuary. If you don't have time to go, I would encourage you to look up Prairie Chicken Dance on YouTube so you can see for yourself how they stamp their little feet. It's a really wonderful thing to see. Later in the program, we'll return to an interview we started last week with Mark Rundquist, who lives on a farm near Melbourne. We were trying to speak to him about how he runs his farm on wind energy last Friday, but we lost our phone connection, so we will try again today. We will also speak with the growing Harmony Farm, which is also wind-powered.
But first, we're going to check with State Representative Lisa Heddens about some of the current issues at the state legislature. I was able to talk with her yesterday, and I'd like to share bits of our conversation with you. This bit begins with my surprise at discovering that the Iowa legislature actually has some bipartisan agreement.
I actually, in your last legislative update, saw the word bipartisan support. What was it that could get bipartisan support in the Iowa legislature?
There's actually a lot of legislation that really does get bipartisan support. I would say that the news oftentimes reflects the things that aren't. But we passed, one issue we passed was in related to the STEM program, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics program. We've also been working on legislation really to focus on job creation incentives and workforce training to help those that are either unemployed or underemployed, to help with those kind of skill building and direct them to possible opportunities within the state.
Well, in this connection with the STEM program, I noticed something about creating more interest in the STEM program. What was that?
Well, it's really trying to look at more individuals to be interested in it, focusing on kids in the school systems, you know, capturing them kind of early and fostering that engagement. Same with those that are going into the post-secondary system of why not go into a science area, or why not go into the mathematics, and just really trying to educate folks why that might be a field to go into.
What is the barrier? Because there are jobs there, and everybody must know that.
I think the barrier tends to be is individuals who sometimes don't feel like that might be the direction that they want to go into, or that they can't for whatever reason. Sometimes, still in this day and age, unfortunately, there is some stereotyping of who might go into a particular field. Not as much, you know, it had been in previous years, but it's really just kind of fostering that confidence and that direction and explaining what fields are open in each of those disciplines.
It used to be that they really had to make a big push to get women interested in those fields, but that isn't so true anymore, is it?
Not as much. They're still trying to work on that, as well as other diverse populations, and again, to kind of direct them and show them that this is a good avenue to go to. With technology as it is anymore, you've got to be. So really trying to direct people into kind of looking futuristically.
So that would be something that would get bipartisan support.
Certainly,
right?
Certainly. It's something that we all see as not only that it had been emerging, but it's really taking off. It makes us competitive not only within the state, but against other states and internationally as well.
Well, in looking at some of your past legislative updates, I noticed something that looked to me like it didn't make it.
Yeah, child care assistance. And I would think that would be very important in helping women complete their education. In some cases, working mothers who needed to improve their skills. And of course, whether they're going to school or just going to work, often the child care is a tremendous burden on medium income as well as low income women.
It is. It's. I would say it's an issue that's not dead yet. The Senate passed over a child care assistance bill that really covered throughout the state. The House Representative Heaton, who ran the bill, amended the bill to really kind of target about four or five counties, more of a pilot project. It's over in the Senate, and I know there's some negotiating on whether you just have it as a pilot project or you go statewide with it. And I think I would agree with you. I think it really does help individuals, particularly women, because it's looking at it more of an aggregate as to how many hours are you working or how many hours are you going to school, and putting those together and stuff instead of looking at it separately, because that can be a barrier for someone to either go to school or to work because they weren't getting that child care assistance.
So if you were to tell us what you thought was the most important issue that was dealt with in the legislature this year, what would it be?
I personally think one of the most important issues that I've been working on actually since last year and served on an interim committee on is focusing on elder abuse in the state of Iowa. We have laws on the books for domestic abuse. We have laws on the books for a dependent adult, but a senior who doesn't follow either of those criteria, who might be abused, who might fall under financial exploitation, which is a huge issue, that's where we have a gap within our system. And so I've been working, as I said, since last year, sponsored some legislation this year, and it's still moving through the process yet. We don't have something final form that's been sent down to the governor, but my hope is that we will.
Well, I would think that would be something that would have pretty strong bipartisan support.
It does. The bill in the House was not moving, and so I actually talked with my colleagues in the Senate and asked them if they would co-companion the bill that I had and had it moving over here. And what it did is it defined elder abuse. It defined it by age, 60 and above. And the only reason for picking that 60-year-old age is because it followed the Federal Older Americans Act. And so the services that our area agencies on aging provide, that's the age that they look at. So I was trying to be consistent with it. It puts in place penalties. So if you abuse someone or exploit someone financially, you want to have penalties to go along with that. It also helped better connect our area agencies on aging that currently is predominantly federally funded, 390 employees, about a $40 million budget, and there's six regions. I was trying to just appropriate some money to pull those regions together. The bill came over from the Senate. The House Judiciary Committee amended it. So my hope is before the session ends, we're kind of negotiating back and forth on that bill as well, that we will have something. It's something that I'm very passionate about. So we bipartisanly passed legislation regarding uniform power of attorney. Want to get this passed, and then kind of my third step would be looking at what's called the Office of Substitute Decision Maker. We had an Office of Substitute Decision Maker in the state, and the funding for that program was cut back in 2009 when we had kind of the Great Recession. We didn't take the language out of statute, and so it's appropriating some money in. And what that program does is it's really looking at someone stepping in as a guardian or conservator, again, of last resort. So it's not the first person that you turn to. If you remember the situation several years ago in Adelissa, where they had several gentlemen that were found from Henry's Farms and they didn't have any family member at that time, that would have been a prime example of a need for having a substitute decision maker to step in.
It's a little difficult to translate the complicated details of the legislation into stories, but I did ask Lisa one question about legislation that we've discussed before on KHOI. You may recall Marie LaFrance, whose son was one of those who benefited greatly from the use of cannabis oil. Here's what Lisa had to say about the legislators' treatment of this issue.
We had a conversation earlier with Maria LaFrance on medical marijuana, and I gathered from something she said that the legislators simply it didn't make it out of committee, and
it didn't move anywhere in the House. I don't know for sure if it moved out of a committee in the Senate at all. I know the Senate's been holding some kind of hearings, listing posts more from individuals. I believe in the House it was sent to the Public Safety Committee, and the Public Safety Chairman said nope, he wasn't going to be bringing it up. I do think it has gotten a lot more notoriety this year. People are getting more educated about it. The governor is hearing a lot more from people on it and the reasoning, not only from individuals who dealt with cancer, for example, but we've had several times we've had parents of kids with seizures who have come down and talked about the benefits of medical marijuana in either eliminating altogether or significantly reducing the number of seizures their children are having in a daytime. So it's definitely something that is more people are getting more educated that maybe next year something would pass through.
One of the things that I learned from my interview with Lisa that I really couldn't put on the air, not because there's anything against it, but because it's so complicated. And that is, she talked at length about the waivers she was working on. And waivers are permissions for people to get the services that they need, even though they may be technically a little bit away from what the narrow descriptions are. And there are thousands of people who have really desperate needs who need these waivers, and they might get passed by the legislature, but they just might not. And it's heartbreaking to think about when you have to deal with the law and you see the need.
What kind of needs are you talking about?
Well, medical needs, needs for, in some cases, respite care. Someone has a very, very difficult situation, somebody they're caring for, a child that is very hard to deal with, and they are basically on 24/7, and they can't even get away for a weekend. They can't get away to go out in the evening in some cases. And other cases are just flat-out medical care or nursing care. These are Medicaid, so they're mostly medical-related situations, but they're defined by someone who isn't thinking about what this means to those people. It's just so much money that you put in the pot.
Right.
But if you would like to be involved, there's another little bit of information that Lisa has for you.
I've run into a number of people who may not want to enter into politics per se, but they have great background knowledge and want to participate in government, and so I encourage them to apply to serve on a state board or commission, and they can go to the governor's website to do that. There's an icon right on there that they can apply.
Thank you, Lisa, for being with us. And now, David G. Smith, who will be playing on Saturday evening, April 12th at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. The song we'll be playing is from his album Nonfiction, which played on over 80 American folk radio stations on the AMA chart for over 24 weeks. This is the first time, I believe, that he's been heard on KHOI. So, Angel's Whisper from the above-mentioned album Nonfiction.
Sunsets and photographs, both memories trapped in color. First kiss and when children laugh, hugs from sons and daughters. Moments so magic, they take your breath. your mind reeling. Time stopped and powerless. Words lose their meaning. Just this side of silence where the angels whisper. Baby sighs and lover smiles, trusting speechless surrenders. Every love and every child and every heart remembers. Moments so magic, they take your breath, leave your mind reeling. Time stopped and powerless. Words lose their meaning. Just this side of silence where the angels whisper.
Tim McCullough is here with us from the City of Ames Electric Services, and thank you, Tim, for joining us today and telling us a little bit about what happened on Saturday night, what caused the power outage.
My pleasure. At 12:27 a.m. on Sunday morning, a raccoon made its way into one of our substations near downtown and found himself on top of a transformer and faulted the transformer, which caused an outage. Right now, we believe about 3,000 customers were affected. So over the course of the following hours, I think all power was restored to customers by about 4 a.m. on Sunday morning. The crews were out and remained at work until all the customers were back online. It affected customers south of Lincoln Way down to about 5th Street, north of Lincoln Way in the downtown area, and even some all the way up near 20th and Duff. Substation feeds most of Central and East Ames.
I was actually returning to Ames from Des Moines, and we were driving up Duff Avenue, and it looked so different in the dark that the driver I was with actually said, "Where are we?"
Yeah, it affects all streetlights, all traffic signals. So, yeah, it makes the evening look a little bit different when you're completely dark on that side of town.
Is there actually somebody at the power plant that notices right away, or does this mean that people have to get up in the middle of the night, or what actually happens?
Most of our outages, we do see indication that people are without power. In some instances, we rely on customers to call in. So in any instance when somebody is out of power, we ask that the customers call our outage hotline at 239-5240 to notify us that they are without power.
Could you repeat that number?
Yes, 515-239-5240. It's an automated hotline, and it will answer the calls and, in most cases, recognizes the phone number from caller ID. And if the customers have registered their phone numbers when they sign up for utility service, it will also recognize the address that the customer's calling from. So about 200 people called in even at 2 a.m. in the morning or 12 o'clock on Sunday morning, and that helped us understand the extent of the outage. And we rely on those calls to help us predict where the problem is. So we can take groups of customers who are fed from the same piece of equipment and then use that to predict where we need to start looking first, where the problem might be.
So you're actually saying it's helpful if people call at a time like that?
Yes, we ask that everybody call. If you have a power interruption and you're a City of Ames Electric Service customer, please call that outage hotline at any time when you're out of power, and we will work to get your power back on as soon as possible.
Well, it did go on pretty quickly again. Did anybody actually have to get up out of bed, or do you have people on call at that time of night?
We have people on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but they work normal day shifts like all of us, but they are also responsible for being on call at night. So they take the call at any hour of the day, and if they're sleeping, they get up and get in the truck and drive to the problem. So we had crew members that were probably in bed at that point, but we had about six people working through the night on Sunday morning to get power restored.
You go out to the power plant and you find a raccoon there, or what? happened?
We find the remnants of a raccoon there on top of the transformer, yes. Unfortunately, it was fatal to the raccoon, but we were able to quickly identify where the raccoon had gotten himself into the high-voltage substation.
Do you know why a raccoon would go in there?
It's warm, it's lighted, they like to explore. I can't give you the exact reason why a raccoon would want to go into a substation. There's not a foolproof way to prevent wildlife from getting into some of the areas where we have high-voltage equipment. And raccoons are crafty animals, so he found himself in a bad situation Sunday morning.
Yeah. Any other real problems that you are aware of from the blackout?
Well, we wouldn't consider this a blackout. This was just a power outage. But other than the 3,000 customers who were out of power, we didn't experience, other than a couple blown fuses, any equipment damage. That's why we were able to restore power as quickly as we were able to, because we had redundant systems able to turn back on. I think all customers were restored by 4 a.m. Some saw power restored earlier. On the sections of town, we were able to get back online quicker. I think the earliest customers were back on by about 1:30 a.m.
The area that had the outage included the hospital and the clinic?
It would have affected the hospital and the clinic, but the hospital has a redundant transfer switch, and they were able to switch over to their alternate power feed. But it would have affected the clinic area, and they would have been out of power for the duration. But the hospital itself does have a redundant power system, and they were able to get back up online quickly.
Actually, KHOI went out, too, and we made a note to ourselves that as soon as we could afford it, we want our alternative energy system, too, because it's hard when a radio station goes down at a time like this. So.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for taking the time, and thank you for your service and getting the power up as quickly as you did.
I'll pass that thanks along to the crews that did the work. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here together with my co-host, Susan Franson. Last week, we started to talk about wind technology or wind energy. And we are speaking to a few farmers this morning who actually use wind energy. Susan, would you go ahead and introduce the first farmer that we're going to be speaking with?
Yes, we'll be talking with Gary Guthrie on his farm about halfway between Ames and Nevada. And are you with us, Gary?
Yes, I am.
Good morning, Gary. Can you tell us exactly where you are?
2 miles south of Brecky's Town and Country Store, just 2 miles south of Highway 30 and 2.5 miles east of I-35.
And your farm has a beautiful name. What is it?
Growing Harmony Farm.
And what do you grow there?
I used to operate a community sport agriculture vegetable garden on 2 acres, and I've scaled back a bit so that I have more time for my parents as they age. But I'm known for my garlic and I'm known for my carrots. I used to grow about 30 different vegetables, but now I'm more on the garlic and the carrots and a few other vegetables.
Now you're growing energy.
Yes, I have been for the last 5 years.
So that's why we're talking with you. And I understand you have both wind and solar on your farm. Could you tell which came first?
Yeah. You know, the whole thing of global warming and carbon footprint, and here we are in windy rural Iowa, and we just felt like we wanted to do something. We were gifted with a little bit of money from my in-laws, and I guess you interviewed Mark Rundquist 2 days ago, and he had a christening of his turbine, and I went to that, and I'm kind of a practical, I need to see something before I kind of invest in something, and he had done his research, and I really liked that turbine, and I liked the man that he bought it from. Southwest Wind was the company. And so talked with my wife, and we decided to make that investment. So it got installed the end of February. It was operational end of February 5 years ago.
And what about the solar part of it? How did that come in?
Well, thanks to the legislature and the tax credits, the solar tax credits by Iowa and the federal government, and solar power has come down in price significantly. Just a little over a year ago, we installed 6 panels. Because the wind was providing about 80% of our electrical needs on average. And so with the 6 solar panels, then now we're 100% for our own household. Last year we combined meters because our parents live next door, so that way we don't have an ongoing credit with Alliant Energy. And so we've reduced my parents' electric bill considerably on a yearly basis as well.
I have a question about storage. Do you have any battery storage so that when it's middle of the night on a hot, still summer night that you have electricity?
We're tied into Alliant Energy, and so they have a net metering meter. It reads when we have excess energy, it goes out on the line, and when we don't, then we pull it off. So it reads actually two different numbers. So that's how we bank it, is through the law is set up that the big energy companies, not for cooperatives as much, but MidAmerican and Alliant are required to do that for people who install their own generation. So that's worked out really well.
For those of us who haven't had a lot of experience with managing energy, am I understanding you correctly that what you're saying is that the way this works is you don't really store your own energy, you connect with the other energy systems, and it's kind of a give and take between what you have and what goes into the general pool. Is that correct?
Yeah. So when electricity is pulled, whenever you're using it, it pulls from whatever source there is. And so before we combined our meters, for example, any excess energy was being really consumed by my parents or my neighbors. And so this electronic meter just measures the electricity going back and forth on the lines. Yes.
And that applies to wind and solar energy?
That's correct. In fact, they have the inverters on the wind turbine. It's actually in the turbine, and on the solar panels, it's actually on the solar panel. So when it's coming down the line into the house, it connects right into our fuse box. And so we're using that electricity immediately. It's all ready to use when it's coming into the house.
It's a very sophisticated system.
It's amazing.
When I first heard what you were doing, I thought, oh, you're living off the grid. But not at all. You're tied into the grid. Is that right?
I am tied into the grid. And we still pay a meter fee for the meter, but it's a lot less expensive because to have a whole array of batteries for storage and all of that, that's considerably quite a bit more expensive to do that.
Do you operate your entire farm on this energy?
Not quite. My parents... We have a grain dryer bin, and so that really sucks the energy in the fall if we use it. So that's a considerable amount of energy. So it's basically supplying all the energy of our needs, of our household needs, except for the grain dryer. And like last year, for example, my parents are snowbirds. So from January through July, they paid about $20 on electricity.
So this is kind of a new approach to supplying energy for your facility. Are you actually paying for the electricity, or are you getting paid for it, or what is the financial side of this?
We pay the meter fee to stay connected, but what they do is the excess that we produce, like January through April in particular, are our windiest months. In fact, this last January was the windiest month we've had here in Story County since... in the last 5 years on average, is that they, what they call banking it. So our excess is credited to us on the bill. And then in the summer months when we're not producing quite as much because it's not as windy, then we draw that bank down.
So what you're essentially doing is reducing your utilities bills with the energy you're creating?
That is correct. Yep.
Well, I have a question about the combined wind and solar. Especially the solar, where you got the big tax rebates. I've heard that that the payback on that is between 5 and 7 years. Is that, of course, you've only had it for a year. Do you think that's going to be realistic, that you'll actually have the solar panels paid for in 5 years?
Well, with the tax credits, yes, and Alliant had a rebate on its own, although they've just continued that. So my solar panels, it cost about, actual cost was $9,300. We spent about $2,400 of out-of-pocket expense. But the way I look at it for the wind and the solar is that if I were to put that money in the bank, what would I be earning? Not very much right now. But even on the wind, of course, when I bought it, it's more like $21,000, $22,000 for my turbine now. But when I bought it at $15,000, if I put that money in the bank, even without the tax credit, that's still 3 or 4% return on investment, because I'm saving $600 to $700 a year because I don't have an electric bill.
Mm-hmm. So that's
the way I kind of look at it. It's return on investment rather than how long is this going to take. How long is this going to take to pay it all off? I'm still earning, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6% on my investment, as well as a hedge on inflation, because I still won't be paying anything on electricity for years to come.
Now, what about maintenance of the system? I know Mark was talking about his having some parts wearing out, and also he said the company's gone out of business now. So what does that mean for you?
So far, I haven't had an issue, although I am going to have it serviced and trying to check on an update. It did go out of business, but it was bought by another company. So I think the turbine is still being manufactured. That is an issue for a lot of turbines. And we bought Southwest because it was such a reliable company, but they made some major investments and made some bad decisions, I guess, and got into financial troubles.
So, Gary, I think you've already answered this question, but would you recommend doing this to somebody else? I mean, not to somebody else. Would you recommend somebody else doing this?
it depends on the different individuals. We're on the southern edge of the windier part of in Iowa, and we had this little, right outside the house, we sided the turbine on the highest point of the whole farm, as it turned out, and it wasn't too far from the house. So it's away from the buildings, the highest point. You know, we had a little extra money, and we just feel like, you know, we can't solve global warming on our own, but we can at least try to do our part. I tell you, it changes your whole perspective on windy days when you have a wind turbine.
And we've had a lot of those recently.
Completely, yeah. It's like, there are some days it's like, oh man, it is a bit windy out there, but it's producing electricity when it's up to 60 miles an hour, so I've yet to see that turbine completely shut off because of excess wind.
There's no danger of it being destroyed by high winds.
You know, a tornado certainly would damage it, but I haven't seen it shut off indefinitely just because of high winds.
When it's really high winds, you feel good.
Yes. Yes. I don't feel good working out in my garden, but at least it's consolation. And then when it's a sunny, windy day, then I'm very, very happy.
Before we close, I have a question. People often will say in Ames, well, they should let us put windmills in our yards. Now, of course, this is in lots that are probably 60 or 75 feet by 150 or 175 feet deep. Is that a feasible idea at all?
You have to have siting where you have to be away from other dwellings. You know, if something were to happen that were to fall, ice or whatever. And so you need a fair amount of space to put up a wind tower. Of course, solar is a whole other thing where you don't need to worry about that. So it's much more practical if you have in town anyway to have solar than it is to have wind. The other thing is, too, that we work very hard at reducing our energy consumption before we put out the wind turbine with compact fluorescent lights, and we took out our electric water heater, and we have a high-efficiency propane furnace that runs our water heater, and so that made a big difference on our electric bill, too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gary, for joining us this morning.
Many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist?
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we were just speaking with Gary Guthrie near Nevada, who has a wind-powered solar and solar energy-powered farm. Last week, we spoke briefly with Mark Rehnquist, who is near Melbourne, Iowa, and we had some problems with the phone, so we lost him. So we'd like to pick up again where we can with you, Mark. Are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
Well, thank you for coming again and joining us again. We're going to kind of start over with some of the questions we asked you before to bring us back up to speed. You're in Melbourne, Iowa?
Yes, we are. Rural Southwest Marshall County.
And you run your farm with a wind turbine, is that correct?
Partially, yeah. We have a 2.4 kilowatt SkyStream wind turbine.
And we just spoke with Gary here in Nevada, and he described that you were his inspiration for building wind power on his farm as well. Would you describe a little bit what led you to do this?
Sure. So we had a small farm, and we were very interested in sustainability for our family. And we had the food down with a small farm, and energy was a big glaring hole in our sustainability. So we looked at different options, and at the time, the wind turbine was the most economically feasible alternative energy to install.
And at the time when you did this, did it feel like something kind of a radical step out of the ordinary, or did it feel pretty natural to do it?
Well, it felt kind of radical because, you know, there's this whole theory of how new things get adopted. You know, the first people who do something are crazy, and then the next level are kind of the early adopters, and then after that, everybody wants to get what those people have. So we kind of felt like we were those crazy first people to put a wind turbine
in the vanguard.
Yeah.
I'd like to put in a personal note, because I remember when you put up your windmill and you had a little ceremony and invited people and had a party. Do you remember that?
I sure do. That was a wonderful afternoon.
And what did your neighbor say when you did this?
Well, my one neighbor said he wanted to run an extension cord over from my wind turbine to his farm. So they kind of watched carefully. I remember one day this farmer came by, and he had his grandson with me and said, "Well, my grandson really wants to take a look at this. Do you mind if he comes and takes a look?" Well, he really wanted to take a look at it up close and personal, and his grandson was his cover. So however we can get him to the farm is okay.
Had anybody besides Gary been inspired to get a wind turbine also?
I'm trying to remember. I know I've spoken with a lot of people who were considering to get one.
What do you grow on your farm?
So we have a small market garden, various vegetables, fruits, berries, nut trees, small animals, just a whole what you would think of a sustainable farm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a question. Would something like this, or maybe even more of them, be useful for a big farm, say 500 to 1,000 acres?
You know, any time that you can kind of take control of your own destiny, so to speak, for energy, I think it's a good idea. So you would just need a bigger turbine for a larger operation.
So how is it really living near a wind turbine? First of all, is it noisy? Are there any dangers involved with it?
So the only zoning ordinance that we had was if the wind turbine fell down, it would have to stay on our property.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been better if we could have moved it closer to the property line. It would have been a little higher and would have fallen in the cornfield, but we couldn't do that. I can kind of tell, so I have some software that immediately tells me how many watts it's producing. And so when I first got it, I was obsessed with kind of listening to the fluttering sound and watching on the computer. So now I can kind of tell by the sound it makes how much energy it's producing. So it's kind of a more of a background hum, but mm-hmm. it's really windy. You don't hear it at all because the leaves from the trees make much more noise than the wind turbine. So that's probably a good way to explain it.
So you don't find that it's not an overpowering noise? It's not
a roar in
your backyard?
No, not at all. Another thing that people worry about is birds. And I've never had, of course I don't go check every day, but I've never seen a bird at the base of the wind turbine as opposed to our front picture window,
mm-hmm.
which commonly catches birds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but that might be because it's not a very tall one compared to the wind farms.
Right. Yeah, so it's on a 100-foot tower, 70-foot tower. We wanted to get a 100-foot tower, but our installer encouraged us to get the lower one because it was much more easier for maintenance. He can just lower it with a battery, like a car battery, and get it back up in a matter of 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But if we had a 100-foot tower, we'd need a crane to get it.
But you said last time that you'd had no maintenance.
Yes. So the only thing we did was the first month we had it up, we had a terrible storm. It blew the grain mill elevator down in Melbourne, into our neighbor's garage. We lost many trees, and it was the first time that that wind turbine had a water inside it, and it stopped working. And the company was shocked because it was rated to 140 miles an hour. So they sent it back to their factory, found out that they had changed the manufacturing process, so that prompted a nationwide recall. But in the end, we were without a turbine for 2 weeks, and they put up a new one with, of course, no cost to us for labor or the new turbine. And that was just like the first few months we had it. And since then, it hasn't been down. But once they did a software upgrade on it, which increased our annual production from 4,000 kilowatt hours to 4,600. So that was quite impressive. So it's been down once since it's been up.
Would you recommend doing this to other farmers?
I would definitely recommend looking at a way to kind of control your own energy costs. The thing is, when I put this in, wind was about twice as cheap as solar, and now it's almost reversed. So I would definitely look at solar first if I was going to do it today, or would look at both, you know, because solar would be more effective in the summer and wind in the windy months. But one thing I do want to say that people really kind of shake their head and they don't follow me is conservation. So I tracked our utility bills for 17 years, and about 5 years before we got the windmill, when we were thinking about these things, we made a concerted effort to reduce our electric usage. So new appliances, high-efficiency light bulbs, and just the more general awareness. And it shocked me that in the 5 years before we got the turbine, our electric consumption dropped the same amount that that wind turbine produced. So our 333 kilowatt hour a month drop in usage was the same as the 333 the wind turbine produced at a much lower cost, just by conservation. So that was very interesting to figure that out.
Well, we're kind of coming to the end of our show. Mark, is there anything else that you want to say about that would be, you think would be educational to us about what it is to have a wind turbine?
Well, I would definitely talk to people who have one, because there, I also know people have had very bad experiences with manufacturers who didn't back them up and installers who did things improperly. So I'd really recommend, if anybody was, to talk to a number of people who have them and find their experiences.
So it really makes a difference whom you buy the wind turbine from. And
exactly. Especially kind of a new technology such as these are.
Right. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and today we have been talking with Mark Rundquist and Gary Guthrie about solar and wind power on farms. Earlier, we spoke with State Representative Lisa Heddens about some of the most important issues in the legislature this year. Your hosts today have been Susan Franson and Ursula Rudenberg.
Local Talk is engineered by Richard Morrison today, and the music you have heard included Blowing in the Wind. That was Bob Dylan, and also Angel's Whisper by David G. Smith from Nonfiction. And of course, our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org, where you'll find an archive of all of the Local Talk shows we've produced since we went on the air in 2012. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage at khoifm.org as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, thank you, Ron, can get the information. There you'll find lists of our guests and links to the organizations and directions how to go hear the Prairie Chickens this weekend if you want to go watch them do their dance.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families donating $20 per month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses, though we'd appreciate whatever fits into your budget. We'd also like to hear your feedback either by phone at 292-2878 or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line.
Please remember to mark your calendar. On April 19th, we will be having our grand opening for the KHOI studios. It will be the culmination of an 8-year-old dream to have community radio here in Central Iowa, and we want to share this with you. So please join the celebration on April 19th at 6 p.m. at our building here in the old Pantorium building at 410 Douglas in downtown Ames. We really look forward to seeing you there.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or at the email khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.